June 3rd marks the 204th birthday of one of the only two native Kentuckians to hold an American presidency. One is, of course, Abraham Lincoln, and the other is his Civil War counterpart, Confederate President Jefferson Davis. Davis was born in Fairview, in what was then Christian County, now Todd, in 1808. Beginning June 1st and running through the 3rd, the Jefferson Davis Birthplace State Historic Site will host a commemoration of the former U.S. Senator and rebel president. There will be exhibits, activities, and Civil War reenactors. But given Davis's place in American history, the question arises as to whether he is someone to be commemorated. For some insight into that question, we turn to Virginia Tech history professor and Civil War scholar William C. Davis, who is no relation. Davis is the author of Jefferson Davis, The Man and His Hour, and Look Away, A History of the Confederate States of America. I'd like to begin by asking about the image we have today of Jefferson Davis. How is he viewed in the 21st century South, and how does that compare with the way the rest of the country sees him?
I'm not really certain that the average American today really has any image of Jefferson Davis. He's a kind of an unknown quantity to people today, very much as he was in his own time. If anything, I suspect the view is of a tall, stern, very distant sort of person who maybe had something to do with causing the Confederacy to lose its bid for independence, which is not unlike the view a lot of people had of him 150 years ago.
One of the impressions that's come down to us today is of a cold, officious man, as you allude to, but one that had to have been affected by the death of his first wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, at a very young age, and by the deaths of some of his children. How are those sides reconciled?
There's no question, in my mind at any rate, that Davis's personality was heavily formed by all the losses of loved ones in his life, most notably his first wife, Sarah Knox Taylor, who I'm convinced was really the love of his life. He had to wait quite a while through courtship to be allowed to marry her, and then when he did, he persuaded her to go south to his plantation in Mississippi during the malaria season by telling her that it would be perfectly safe, even though he knew it wasn't. And, of course, within a matter of a few weeks, both of them are afflicted with malaria, and she dies. I think Davis never said anything about feeling guilty over that, but I don't see how he could not have felt guilty of it, over it for the rest of his life. And there's no question that his personality underwent a change. He was a fun-loving and almost impish young man before her death. Indeed, at West Point, he'd been virtually a party boy. But after her death, he became very serious, sober, morose, and is really never the same individual. And then add to that, when he marries his second wife, Davis will have four sons, and he outlives all four of them. That's a tremendous amount of loss for a man to suffer. And that's one of the reasons, I think, indeed, that he was perhaps the last ever to accept that the Confederacy was beaten in 1865. It was unthinkable to him that this nation, which I think he viewed very much like another one of his sons, that he could no more get it into his head to peacefully preside over its demise than he could watch another one of his sons die.
That leads to the next question, is how we square the impressions of former Senator Davis, who accepted the Confederate presidency a bit unwillingly, with that Davis who was captured in Georgia in 1865, who was apparently bent on continuing the war at all costs.
Yeah, I think by the beginning of 1865, certainly for most Confederates, the re-election of Abraham Lincoln in November 1864 was the handwriting on the wall that the North was willing to stick with this war for another 4 years if it had to, and most thinking people's judgment told them that the longer the war went on, the less chance there was of the South winning. Even Davis himself early on had said that their best hope of winning was that the North would be willing to lose, as long as they could stay alive long enough for the North to lose its will to continue paying out blood and treasure to reunify the Union, why the Confederacy was in a way winning. The election of Lincoln put the quietus to that. But Davis just seemed to refuse to see it. I think by the spring of 1865, he's occasionally what we would today call delusional. It's always dangerous to try to put somebody on the couch when they're not there to speak for themselves. But I think Davis's unrealistic expectations, especially in April in 1865, indicate that he simply wasn't thinking very clearly. He had notions of somehow fleeing across the deep south through Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, even into Louisiana, and that phantom legions of Confederate men who had either not come forward to enlist or who had deserted or who had left the army because they were in poor health would somehow flock to his banner with weapons, and a new army would coalesce around him that he would then lead back to win all that was lost and gain their independence. That was a chimerical pipe dream at that point.
Davis was a slaveholder living in Mississippi, and his defenders always point out that he was what you might call an enlightened one. Could you talk a bit about how he dealt with his slaves?
Davis, there's a lot of interesting contrasts in the man, and two of them that always strike me is, A, he had traveled very little in the South prior to the Civil War. He really knew the North better than he knew the South based on personal observation. And secondly, I don't think Davis ever really understood what slavery was like across the average of the whole South, because his plantation, his management of his slaves, was very much atypical. A statute law in most southern states denied planters the right to educate their slaves, to teach them to read or to write, and yet Davis had a school for his slaves. Davis brought in and paid a minister to come hold religious services for his slaves. He encouraged his slaves to have a fair degree of independence, allowing them to have their own gardens in which they could raise crops partly for their own tables, but the residue could be used to earn a little money to buy themselves some luxuries. He would not put up with an overseer who mistreated his slaves, and in fact set up a sort of slave judicial system whereby a slave who committed an infraction was tried by his or her peers. These things are very unusual anywhere else across the South. And I think Davis just sort of assumed that the way he treated his slaves was the way everyone treated slaves. Therefore, he had a hard time understanding the Northern opposition to the idea of slavery and all these epithets cast on it as an evil and brutal institution.
Just before the war, he did speak out against civil war, I suppose, a secession, even though he did argue that it was constitutional for a state to secede. How did he square that circle?
Davis is, contrary to a misconception then and later, I think Davis is essentially a moderate, which of course is why he was probably the best choice for president that the new Confederacy had. Revolutions are usually started by extremists on the far left or the far right. But once a revolt gets going, most people very quickly head toward the center, where there's the greatest strength. So the arch secessionists who brought about secession were virtually frozen out of the Confederate government once the Confederacy set up, as everybody went looking for someone who was a man in the middle who could attract the most support. And Davis had always been pro-slavery, but not adamantly so. Davis had always been a Southern rights politician, but he wasn't one of the arch secessionists. He'd always spoken out for the Union as long as the South could remain within the Union in good conscience, from his point of view. He did indeed argue that secession was an inherent right, but that it was best to stay within the Union instead. And that doesn't make him at all unique. That attitude is very common in the border states of Virginia and Kentucky and Missouri, for instance. I think Davis had a genuine attachment to the Union, but when it could no longer provide the benefits that it was supposed to be providing to the states, and when the states could no longer, as they felt, protect themselves against usurpations by the Union, then it was time to leave. It's not really an inconsistent attitude. It's much like anybody today who would sing the praises of marriage, but when it's no longer working, suddenly divorce is a legal option.
What is Jefferson Davis's legacy today, 150 years out, and is it one we should be commemorating? I mean, I use that word specifically because that the event that is in Fairview next week is called a commemoration.
I think it's worthwhile for people to understand at least something about Jefferson Davis, because it can help them understand the Confederacy itself and what led to the Civil War that is still defining us today. It's too easy to dismiss the Confederates as arch pro-slave people who are somehow sort of radically dedicated to destroying the Union. They were genuinely a people who were caught in a bind, one of those rock and hard places that history simply throws at people, that slavery was an accomplished fact and it was lawful where it then existed. They had very good reason to fear that the way federal legislation was going could one day lead to an assault upon slavery where it existed, which would have eradicated about $4 billion worth of capital investment in the South, the largest single form of property there was. Virtually not just Southern economy, but Southern society was in danger of collapse if slavery collapsed. And Davis is one of those people who accepted the thankless and probably no-win task of trying to stand up for their view of rights when they clashed with the view of the rights of Americans. Davis, I think, deserves some respect. I think, personally, I would not have liked the man if I met him just because of his personality. But I feel a lot of empathy for him, for the task he was given, the way he threw himself into it to the exclusion of virtually every other aspect of his life, including his health. And he's a man who stood up for what he believed and sacrificed almost everything for it. And we should all at least be able to respect, if not admire, that.
I get the feeling that you still believe he's very much relevant today. But that leads me to wonder if there was one thing that people really should know about Jefferson Davis, what would that be?
I guess my answer to that would be something on the micro scale rather than the macro. Because of this image that I mentioned at the very beginning of this cold, aloof, austere man, the thing I like best about Davis is that he became absolutely foolish in the presence of children. He just loved children because he'd lost so many of his own, I suppose. They are the only people with whom he was ever, I think, completely at ease. My guess is because in his time and place, children, blacks, and women were the social inferiors of an adult white male, so they couldn't challenge him. But with children especially, he just become almost goofy. He just loved to play with them. The last Christmas in the Confederate White House in 1864, there's a wonderful account by his wife, Verena, of him trying to pass out the presents to neighborhood children, and how he got it all messed up and confused, and he tangled up in the tree decorations and everything else. But he was just having so much fun. And it's, fun is not a word anyone really associates with Jefferson Davis.
Professor Davis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kentucky's commemoration of Jefferson Davis takes place June 1st through the 3rd at the Jefferson Davis State Historic Site in Fairview.